When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We're going to do like quarterly question and answers for people who are newly diagnosed. And then the other thing that I felt was really important is just reminding, you know, helping remind the people and providers that it's not just a diagnosis. It's a person behind that. Mm-hmm. And so we're finding a way, we haven't quite figured this part out yet, but to have everybody tell kind of a little bit about them. So for example, tell me five things you want every provider to know about you.
Mm-hmm.
I was a Vietnam veteran.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of, I'm a triplet. Things like that, so that, you know, every provider comes in and starts to see it. I don't want to just learn about somebody because I read their obituary.
Right.
I want to know about everything else before that.
And they're a person.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's so important to bring that piece into it. And so that is something. So I love the example you gave. And I think that would be like a good thing for providers too.
Welcome to The Secret Life of Parkinson's, a podcast created by people living with Parkinson's to help break the stigma of a disease no one likes to talk about. Now here are your hosts, Jessica Krauser and Ryan Baker.
Thanks for coming on. Yeah,
thanks for having
excited.
Me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So Ellen Walter, yes. We have you in the studio.
Yes.
This was all your doing.
That's right.
You couldn't wait to have her in.
Nope, that's right.
And why excited. Is that?
Oh, that's so sweet.
Because she takes care of me.
She takes care of him. So, Ellen, tell us what you do at the Cleveland Clinic.
Sure. So I am a nurse practitioner. So I see individuals who have Parkinson's in the office in my clinic. So I see people who are in any stage of their Parkinson's, so maybe newly diagnosed or somebody who's had it yesterday, somebody that has had it for 40 years
mm-hmm.
and actually doing really, really well. So big shout out to her. And I see them and help manage their medications, help manage not just medications, but I'm sure at some point you guys have talked about the non-motor symptoms. So all the other aspects of that can go along with Parkinson's, depression, anxiety, sleep issues, things like that. And then I also work with the deep brain stimulators.
Mm-hmm.
So I help evaluate people for those. We do the programming of them. And that pretty much wraps up the clinical side of things. Mm-hmm. And then we are the only Ohio Parkinson's Foundation Center of Excellence. Mm-hmm. And I'm the coordinator of our Center of Excellence. And so as part of that, I try to create programs, so try to do initiatives to help build our practice. So just like I was just talking about with the people who are newly diagnosed mm-hmm. and trying to make this a better experience for them, but then also a lot of community outreach. So I try to build programs. We work with and collaborate with others in the community. Right now, we're collaborating with In Motion
yeah.
to try and reach some underserved populations,
right.
try to educate them about Parkinson's disease and hopefully get them the care and education and emotions part, the exercise and things like that. So that's pretty much my role as the COE coordinator.
Okay. How do you, so you're, when you talk about medications, even just like from the non-motor side, are you able to then suggest or prescribe then, like let's say something for depression, or do they still have to go to their primary care?
No. So if somebody's having a lot of depression, you know, we kind of talk about if they know, is there something specific going on?
Right.
You know, somebody might have just had a death in the family or something mm-hmm. else like that. But we obviously know that Parkinson's in a lot of people with Parkinson's, they have a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. And so if they don't have like a known cause and it seems to be more related to the disease, then we talk about like what is the best approach for them. Do they maybe want to just talk to somebody or, you know, see a therapist or a psychologist? We have social workers that do counseling as well. Mm-hmm. That might not do the trick just mm-hmm. because it's, yes, somebody might have been depressed if they just got a diagnosis, but a lot of times it's not a situational depression. Mm-hmm. It is the chemical changes in the brain that come along with it. And so sometimes they do need medication. So I can prescribe.
Okay.
And I will prescribe their medication. Now, if it gets to the point where we've tried a couple things and it's not really working for them, you know, there's people who went to school for several years just for that. I'm not going to pretend to be the expert. Mm-hmm. So if we've tried a couple things that haven't worked, then that's when I get our psychiatry involved. And we have an awesome team.
I just ask because I think I had to go back to my primary care physician to get prescribed on Zoloft mm-hmm. when I was going through everything. So it's good to hear that, like, because I don't understand like why it doesn't stay within the neurology group, because I'm like, it's Parkinson's related. I know it is. It's like, cause it was probably one of my first symptoms and I didn't even know it, you know?
Right. But there are a lot of things that we will do, like depression, orthostatic hypotension. So the drops in blood pressure when somebody stands and sometimes people can develop. Again, it's a similar concept as a depression. We'll start with some of the treatments. I never jump right to medication. Always start with conservative measures, raising the head of bed, drinking a lot of water, you know, different types of exercises, things like that. But then if it needs medication, same thing. I'll do a little bit. But if we get somebody who has a blood pressure of 200 over 110 and 5 minutes later their blood pressure is 80 over 40.
Oh, my God.
Then I might get a cardiologist involved who really specializes in orthostatic hypotension, or even if it's just more straightforward orthostatic hypotension, but for some reason it's not responding to the medications, then I'll get somebody involved. And I feel like that's the case with a lot of things. Like if it's a Parkinson's symptoms, like sometimes if somebody has an overactive bladder, same concept, we might start them on something. I'm a little bit less likely to do that than some other, you know, providers. I will do it some. But I had a situation with a guy who he would get urinary tract infections all the time. He would end up in the hospital, and I wasn't the one who prescribed this medication, but he was prescribed a medication for overactive bladder, and here he had like an opposite problem. So the medication he was taking was kind of fighting that problem, and that's why he kept up ending up in the hospital. And as soon as they took him off the medication, that stopped. So that was like a lesson for me, even though I wasn't the one who prescribed it. Like, okay, you know, maybe I can try this on somebody. If it doesn't work, like not try a zillion drugs, send them, you know, to a urologist and make sure that we're actually treating the right problem.
Right. So I know Steve is on with us today and Yay. Brian's in the back room with Melissa. But so, Steve, I know you just had a lot to share and a lot of excitement because of, you know, you going through DBS through the Cleveland Clinic, and you worked a ton with Ellen, and she's helped you in so many different ways, even recently. So I thought I'd all hand it over to you.
Excellent. Well, let's talk DBS.
Sure.
His favorite topic. Yeah.
My biggest concerns have always been tremors, and I've actually had great control on my right side. I think it only took something like maybe 2 or 3 months to get really good control on this side. But my left side, it's been problematic. It's just really been stubborn, and we've probably been working on that maybe 2.5 years. And a few months ago, I began developing some speech issues where it became more difficult to maintain a good volume. And it took more air to make sounds of my vocal cords. But I went through some speech therapy, and it fixed the problem. But this time was different. And no matter how much therapy I did, I couldn't help my problem. And I went through all sorts of tests. I swallowed cameras, stomach x-rays, swallowing tests, and a series of medications as well. And nothing helped. So my ENT doctors were just kind of shaking their heads. So when it came time for my next session with Ellen, I mentioned my voice issues. And she immediately said that sounded like DBS to her. And I mean, that just hit me like a ton of bricks, because I've actually been increasing my milliamps, about 1 milliamp a month, to try to get better control in my right hand. And I didn't think to mention it to my ENT, and obviously he would have no reason to ask about my DBS. I mean, we just didn't think of doing that. But I was relieved that we could now finally get it fixed with Ellen.
Like, how do you fix it? You just adjust the dial?
Well, that
the little button for him, I think it was a little bit more complicated than that. Just because sometimes that can be the case. Sometimes you can just like go down a little bit, but then they don't necessarily have the control that they had, which is why we got to where we got in the first place, or where he got to where he was. And I think the tricky thing with speech, one of the challenges with it, is they don't typically see it in the operating room, like when they're testing things out. They may, but in the people who develop it later, that wasn't something. If we look back at the operating room notes, that's not something we see, like, oh, they had speech in the OR. Sometimes when we do what's called a monopolar review, so when somebody first has DBS, they come in, if they're on meds, they come in off their medication, and we check out each of what's called the contacts. So on the electrode, there's different contacts, and we test them out one at a time. And we look at what point do we see, if we see benefit that first visit, at what point do we see it, and then when do we see the side effects. And the side effects could be speech problems. It could be vision problems. They could feel tightening of a muscle, or, you know, a number of other sensations, tingling, a heat sensation. So when do we see that? When do we see the benefit? And that kind of creates a window for us that we know we don't want to go beyond that point, at least, you know, initially. A lot of times in people that develop speech problems, we don't see it during the monopolar review either. And what we find, and this is the challenging part, is that it's sometimes somebody's just on settings for a long time and then they develop speech problems. Or as, you know, he mentioned, going up in that short time in the office, no, we didn't see it, but put you on those settings for a long time and you might develop those speech problems, because as you go up on the stimulation, you start hitting other parts of the brain.
Yeah.
And not just the area you're looking for. And there's so many changes in technology that can help with that, like try to help avoid those areas, but it's not perfect. And in somebody who has a really stubborn tremor or other stubborn Parkinson's symptoms that we're trying to help, it's pretty common that we're going to start hitting those other places because we need more and more of the stimulation.
So, and that's what I had. Mine was stubborn.
But yeah, yours was stubborn because you wanted to tie your shoes.
So what did you then do? Did you start taking meds, or did you just adjust your DBS?
Well, we had talked about trying some levodopa. And after 6 years of DBS with no meds, I thought it was time. So I contacted Dr. Walter. I told him what I wanted to do. An hour later, I started on a half a Cinemet pill 3 times a day. And I was amazed at the end of the second day. My voice started coming back.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So is that just because of the lack of dopamine that, like, or just because DBS doesn't control that part, or what?
So both. So DBS does not help the speech, but as you can see, it can affect it. Again, we can see this side effect as we go up on the stimulation, but it doesn't help speech. It doesn't help things like speech, swallowing, constipation, mood. It's more the movement symptoms. So slowness, stiffness, tremor, things that respond for that individual specifically to the levodopa. And then in regards to why did the Cinemet help? Because yes, you're right. If somebody came to me with speech problems, I'm not going to give them Cinemet, right? But when somebody's lacking the dopamine for a while, then giving them some Cinemet might help some of those. And one example that Ben and I were actually talking about earlier is we had an individual that we see that had to go into a rehab facility after they had like a knee replacement or something like that. And there's a medication called entacapone, and entacapone has to be taken with Cinemet. It cannot work on its own. The person went to the rehab facility, and I get this frantic call from the wife, you know, he can't swallow, he can't do this, he can't do that. And I'm like, can you have them fax the medication over? You know, I was thinking maybe he was getting something he shouldn't get, like you guys were, you know, have talked about. But actually what it was is they got rid of his Sinemet and just gave him entacapone. And he had the disease for like 12 years. Oh. So you had somebody who has been taking levodopa for approximately 12 years, took that completely away, gave them the only medication that has no action. And so again, you wouldn't use Sinemet to treat swallowing, but you took all that dopamine away from him. So when you gave it back, he was able to start swallowing again. So, yeah.
So I have a question, though. This is not related to you. And I don't know if maybe you have experienced this, too, or not. But Brian and I had this discussion the other day, and I said he was wrong. He said I was wrong. So I think you're going to tell me I'm wrong. But he said he felt like he was getting dyskinetic, but he doesn't take any medication yet. He's still just doing the DBS. Mm-hmm. But I just thought it was carbidopa-levodopa that makes, and I know it's like obviously the more dopamine you have, that's what makes you dyskinetic, I think. But I thought that that was the reason why people went to DBS, so that they can not be dyskinetic from the carbidopa-levodopa.
Yes, sometimes that is one of their goals, is to not have the dyskinesia. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times by getting the DBS, it will allow somebody to back down on medication. You talked about two very rare circumstances of people not taking medication, and that is,
I know,
that is rare. That is like on this end of the bell curve. But the stimulation itself can actually cause dyskinesia too. Hmm. And so when somebody comes to us and one of their goals is dyskinesia and they have really bad dyskinesia, we always tell them that this might make your programming more challenging, because it's a little bit of going up on the stimulation and then a little bit of backing down on the medication, a little bit, and finding that balance is really, really challenging. And it also requires a lot of patience. Mm-hmm. If somebody goes up a lot on their own, because they're thinking more is better and they're going up a lot on their own, they can create a lot of dyskinesia and some other problems that go along with that. And so it's hard because you go through so much. You go through this long evaluation process. You go through this big brain surgery and more than one surgery. It's not just, you know, at our center, it's not just the one. You want to be better. And yeah. I don't blame you. But when you have dyskinesia, it is a much slower process. So he could be right that the dyskinesia could be coming out with the stimulation. It might be related to him, most likely, if he's increased it at all. That would be a reason. It's possible, like, if he's just, you know, been on the settings, the longer. And then if there's any, like, stressors or something, a lot of people have more dyskinesia when they're stressed out. It might be a good stress. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be a bad stress. It could be, like, a good emotion.
Yeah. Yeah, I get more dyskinetic. Like, I'm comfortable here, which is great. Not that I'm not uncomfortable at dinner, but if I'm out at dinner and I'm just talking to a friend or whatever, I can tell I'm way more dyskinetic. And it's a good one. Like I'm happy, yeah. You know, but it just comes out that way. Mm-hmm. Do you get dyskinetic?
A little bit, but not much. We came back in for a 3.5 hour session, which, by the way, she took a vacation day to come in to help me with my adjustments.
Oh, my gosh.
And during that 3.5 hours, I talked probably 2.5 hours.
No.
And you're looking at a guy that, in some days, doesn't say 10 words a day, you know.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, you talk all the time when I see you.
Yeah.
Well, I know. I was surprised to hear that.
I
was surprised to hear that, too.
Where's your wife?
But that she knows more about me than a lot of people do.
Well, and I think, and this kind of goes back to the question you were asking, like, what do we do for his speech? And, you know, we were talking about the Sinemet a little, and how it's not just a matter of going down. So that's why he had to talk so much, because, you know, with Boston Scientific's program, you can kind of just go up the electrode, you can start to turn it to see. And so that's what I was doing with him. And, you know, sometimes people say the days of the week for me, mm-hmm. over and over and over again. I don't typically use that. I think that sometimes people just naturally stumble over and then everybody gets caught up on that like one S or something. Mm-hmm. And nobody walks around their house saying the days of the week, right? Mm-hmm. But people do have conversations with other people.
Yeah.
So usually I just have people tell me stories about, you know, tell me how you met your wife. Tell me about some of your, he's had a lot of careers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, tell me about this. And so that also meets that thing I was talking about when we were talking about people who are newly diagnosed, is just knowing people, like learning about who people are. And so I kind of get to do that. So yeah, so he spent a lot of time talking because I'd be like, and then I'd be like, okay, you can wait a second because I need to do something. And I would do it. And then I'd be like, okay, I just want you to talk for the next, you know, until I tell you to stop. And then I would just start doing things and moving up, moving down, turning it around and just doing different things until we found a spot that was still relatively good for the tremor, but not causing him to feel as uncomfortable from a speech standpoint. Hmm.
So we wound up with two settings, one for speech and one for tremors.
What do you mean, like two? There are they? You can only have one or the other, or it's set for both?
No, it was one or the other, because that's just the tremor was way off from the speech setting.
Yeah, and I think we actually had three. Like when you came in on, and it's not like he had, like, there's no tremor control at all. It's just that maybe it wasn't as good. It's like better on this one than this one. And then, and sometimes you could just kind of turn it up or down and to meet one or the other, but his programs are completely different. So if there's a situation where he really wants to make sure that, you know, I mean, clearly, like, look at him. Like, actually, speech sounds good. He's not having tremor. He looks great. So
what setting do you have on right now?
It's the tremor setting. But the thing that made a difference that allowed me to use a tremor setting was CINEMAT.
Okay.
And I think that speaks to such an important thing that it is really the combination of the DBS and medications a lot of times that get people the control they need and not just one or the other. I mean, sometimes not everybody's a candidate for DBS. And so, you know, they have medications. But for people who do have DBS, it's really rare, like I was saying, for people to not be on medications. And so it's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I know he doesn't want, you know, you don't want to take medication, but it's not necessarily a bad thing that like the DBS didn't 100% control everything, because technically if you look at the data of like how much, what the percentage is, we wouldn't expect it. When we get 100% control, super excited. When we get 100% control of, you know, say a head tremor or something that we don't expect, even more excited. But really, we expect more the combination of the medications to do the trick. And even then, I mean, it's not perfect. It doesn't take away the disease. It doesn't cure it.
Yeah.
And people are still likely to have, you know, symptoms and some symptoms that bother some.
So with DBS, then, so when people go in for it or when you're getting your settings, you know, adjusted, is it like, right? Like I have rigidity, dystonia, and now I'm becoming like dyskinetic because of the increased carbidopa levodopa. So if I were to go in for DBS, would I then say like, okay, my focus, like you almost have to have a focus then, right? Like mine would probably be rigidity. Is it then like all the what do I want to say? Like the settings. God, I can't think. So the settings would be focused on helping rigidity, right?
Helping the Parkinson's symptoms overall. So to back up a little, so that would be part of the evaluation. Okay. So part of the evaluation, you would come in off your medication and somebody would evaluate you, but you would bring your medication with you. So we'd evaluate you with the UPDRS, so what you guys have done a zillion times. And then you would take your medication, and then when it kicked in, you would be evaluated by the same person. And we would look at what improved. So if we did not see any improvement in rigidity, but that's really what you wanted, we wouldn't operate on you.
Got it.
Even if you had a horrendous tremor and I thought I could really help, you know, that we could really help that tremor, if all you wanted fixed was rigidity and it did not get better with medication, we wouldn't operate on you because then we would not be, you know, even having a chance to reach your goal. Now, if you did get better, if your rigidity did get better once you took your medication and we knew that was a reasonable goal, then as we can't like necessarily direct it towards rigidity or towards whatever, but just as you did it, you would start to get improvement in, in the all the symptoms that we would expect to help.
What are some like common concerns or misconceptions? And you kind of highlighted a couple where Brian and Steve are like the anomaly. Like they're most of the time people are still taking medication. It's like, a, it's a, it's a delicate balance between medication and the DBS. They, well, I think because you guys are stubborn too, that you don't take medication.
Yeah, that would be accurate.
Yeah.
Well, for Brian.
Yeah. But so what, you know, how do you address those, or what are those other common concerns or misconceptions that patients or caregivers have about DBS that you want to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a big one. And I try to tell people it's kind of like the bell-shaped curve where you have some people who actually, those rare circumstances where they actually go off medications, you actually have some people that end up on more medication for whatever reason, but they're still in a better place. And then most people kind of fall somewhere in between. So I think the medications is a big one. I think that even though, and I 100% understand this, even though I feel like we do a really good job educating, like, this is not going to take all your symptoms away, this isn't going to cure the disease, there is still this hope in people that it will.
Yeah.
And so when that doesn't happen, there is some disappointment. So I'm not sure that's a misconception because it's out there that, but I still think there's this high hope. And I understand, right? It's something, and I do have people like that. I can think of somebody off the top of my head who, you know, he didn't have as good a percentage as we would want for improvement. So what he, you know, and I said, listen, I said, I think the only thing we can have as a goal for you right now is tremor and dyskinesia. So if that's not what you want, then, you know, and he was like, yeah, I'm going to hold off for a little bit. And then he called me one day and he said, no, I'm going to go for it. And I said, okay, just making it clear. Goals are, you know, he said, yes. Inside, I truly felt that he was going to do better than our numbers showed, just because I knew him so well. I've known him for years. I've known what he has felt like during his off times, what he's felt in his on time. So inside, I felt like he was going to do better, but we couldn't say that. And sure enough, he actually did. So he's one of those, again, a circumstance that, yeah, it didn't show in our testing, but he got a lot more improvement than, you know, we told him he could get and that we expected. But that's not usually the case. And I think we need to be really clear because we don't want to disappoint people. It's hard enough. And there's already some unexpected disappointments that we have. We don't want to knowingly disappoint someone and set up wrong expectations.
Yeah. And for so many years, I was, you know, without meds. I can only imagine the difficulty in adding medications to the DBS to, because, I mean, you're spinning a lot of plates, you know.
Yeah. No, exactly. And the circumstance where we would do that, where it's on the far end, maybe in somebody that despite our best efforts, they're still having a lot of dyskinesia, because that can happen, you know, despite how hard we try. And so maybe we add the only medication that we have in our arsenal that actually, you know, helps the dyskinesia rather than cause it, which is the amantadine or the extended release form, the Gocovri. Or maybe we switch their Sinemet to the Rytary. And so maybe actually if we convert the levodopa, it's not more levodopa, but it feels to the person they're taking more, because maybe the one tablet of Sinemet is equal to about three of the Rytary capsules for one dose. So now they're taking more capsules. So even if, like, again, the equivalence isn't more, they feel like they're taking more. So there's a couple of different circumstances where you get those rare situations where they're taking more. And again, it's not a lot, but it can happen. So I think that, and then I think, again, talking about like potential side effects, and, you know, there's that this thought, like, I think when it happens to people, they're always surprised, because, and this is why this is perfect, right? Because we're not saying like this is 100% perfect. But when we show videos, when you go onto YouTube and the internet and you see videos, it looks like a light switch. You turn it on, oh, I'm doing great. You turn it off, things are horrible. It doesn't speak to all the other things that can happen, that even if we educate about them, it's still, that might not sink in, because when you come in for an evaluation, you are getting so much information. And we're in the process actually of developing a new education booklet to try to help with some of that.
It's overwhelming.
It's very overwhelming.
So when you get your settings adjusted, and, if he was already on medication, so those that are on medication and have had DBS and they're coming in for like a settings adjustment, do you also have to adjust their meds anytime you adjust their settings? Or how do you know?
Yeah. So I think I will say everybody does this a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. I tend not to adjust two things at once.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if I have somebody who's really complicated and such a, like, you know, some speech problems I'm trying to figure out, or part of their dyskinesia, they have a lot of dystonia or something like that, I try not to even adjust both sides at once. Like I try to – now, at the beginning, I will adjust both sides at once. But if I get into a situation where somebody starts – you know, there's some complicated factor, I try to only adjust one side at once, because that way we're not all this way into it and then they call me 2 months later and say, I'm having this problem, and I'm like, huh, which of these things was
yeah.
it? So I try not to adjust two sides at once unless, you know, it's towards the beginning or unless they're not having problems. And I try not to adjust medications on the same day. The exception to that is if in the office on just a really tiny amount of stimulation, they're having a lot of dyskinesia.
Mm-hmm.
And then I will. I might within a week make some adjustments to their medication, but I don't want to do it the same day.
Yeah.
Because then again, it's that same thing. Is it because I did mm-hmm. this or is it because of the stimulation?
Yeah.
So I try to do things separately.
Cool.
When I came home and I decided to do this, Melissa sent, she's always sending.
She sends us emails all the time, and then she gets really mad if you don't read
it. Yeah, just delete.
She's like on fire back there.
But she sent me the Stanford research, and the researchers noticed a subset of patients who performed particularly poorly on the spoken verse of the test without medication. And that their spoken performance increased significantly with medication. I'm like, this is me.
You know? And I did read that when you sent it.
Yeah, I mean, did. That's exactly what happened to me. So, thanks, Melissa.
Yeah. Melissa.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa, because I think you might have helped him, you know, think that the cinema is an okay thing. Yeah.
It validated.
Yeah.
Get over your stubbornness.
Yeah.
Yes.
This was great. This was very educational for me. I mean, we've talked to how many people with DBS, and this
a lot.
I didn't know all of this, and I'm asking even more questions now because I was talking to my neurologist, and because I'm coming up on my five year anniversary of being diagnosed.
Hard to believe.
Yay! But I mean, Brian thinks I'm ready for DBS, but I'm still, like, she said, you know, I have time, but she's like, it's definitely something to making sure that you're thinking about and considering, and you know, just seeing how your day to day goes. And so the more I think about it, that it's like potentially in my future, even though, again, we've talked about it a lot, it's like, it is scary. It's like, I honestly don't know if I'm ready to do it, you know, and maybe it's, I have to wait till I get, you know, there are more symptoms because I just don't feel like, I don't know.
Can I comment on that?
Oh, sure.
So I think that you have to be 100% ready, and not just to accept like the good thing that can come from DBS, but also if, you know, there was some type of, you know, you are young and mm-hmm. if there was something. So I think you have to be 100%. And I feel like I'm very careful when I counsel people on that, you know, not to like overpromise and mm-hmm. then also just say like, oh, it will be fine. You know, we have a really low adverse event profile. Our surgeons are, you know, they're very experienced. They're conservative in their approach. You know, it's done differently all around the country. But our adverse events is really, really low. It doesn't matter how low it is if you're the one person who has it. Mm-hmm. So I think 100% you have to be ready. On the flip side of that coin is, I have seen people who have said, you know, I'm not ready, I'm not ready, I'm not ready. And then when they say they're ready, they're no longer a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be for a variety of reasons. It could be because of some medical issue. It could be, I mean, there's so many reasons why maybe they're not a candidate now. And that is heartbreaking, because when I used to work on the surgery side, so when I first became a nurse practitioner, I worked with a neurosurgeon who did DBS. And so I was on the surgery side of things. And I will tell you, the hardest part of that job was going with a surgeon, and thank God it was very rare, but the hardest part of that job was going with a surgeon to tell a family that the person having surgery had a bleed in their brain.
Mm-hmm.
That was by far the hardest part. You know, because I had gotten to know these people. I was mm-hmm. along with them the whole process. That was the hardest part. The second hardest part was telling somebody that they weren't a candidate for surgery when they felt like this was their big hope. Mm-hmm. And that's how it feels, especially because some of these people who like say they're not ready. If they're the person that I see, I know them so well and everything they've been through. So to have to then say you're not a candidate. So there's a window of opportunity.
And why wouldn't you be a candidate anymore?
Yeah. So some of the reasons. So the first reason would be if you just say you didn't have tremor and your response to levodopa wasn't that great, mm-hmm. then you wouldn't be a good candidate. Because again, the things that we expect to improve with DBS are those things that improve with levodopa. The two exceptions to that are tremor, because a lot of people's tremor doesn't respond, mm-hmm. but it does respond well to DBS. The other is dyskinesia, because we can lower the medication. Mm-hmm. And then there's also a plate, like one of the places they can put it in the brain can also, you know, help with that. So that might be one reason. Another reason they're not a candidate is what I already talked to you about, is if you wanted rigidity and all I thought it would help your tremor, then they wouldn't be a candidate. Mm-hmm. If somebody had a really severe depression or anxiety that wasn't well managed, that would be a reason. That wouldn't be like a game ender. We would say, you know, let's work on this. And if we can get it to a point where it's better controlled, mm-hmm. then they would be a candidate. And then the last one would be, and there's probably some others, but the last big one is if they've developed some cognitive problems, then they would not necessarily, and it depends. I mean, everybody, has cognitive problems to an extent, as we get older, whether you have Parkinson's or not, a lot of us experience different changes. Yeah. But if you're at a certain level, then you would not be a candidate. And that's why part of the evaluation is neuropsychological testing, mm-hmm. where you go, 3-4 hours of doing different tests, mm-hmm. to make sure that you are okay, yeah. From a cognitive standpoint. So those are the big reasons. And then I guess the other one that I talked about too is just if you have a lot of other medical things going on,
yeah. mm-hmm.
maybe you have diabetes, mm-hmm. and you develop a lot of infections, that would not make us overly excited, yeah. about putting an electrode in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had my surgery 18 months after I was diagnosed.
Another,
oh, really?
Another, yeah. rarity.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. I thought you had to wait like usually 4 to 5 years after
so
diagnosis?
So not necessarily. There are some circumstances, okay. But there have been a couple situations where somebody might get it done sooner, like especially if they're what we call tremor predominant, like that is their main mm-hmm. symptom and it interferes with their daily life. So I remember like when I worked with the neurosurgeon, we operated on somebody who also, it was a very short time, and his was tremor predominant. He was having a hard time. He was a photographer and he was having a hard time functioning at work because of his mm-hmm. tremor. And so that was somebody we did a little bit earlier. And there was a couple reasons, but it's not always ideal.
Yeah. You're just special.
I know it. I know it. You need to tell more people.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, he is. He's special. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Is there anything else that you had?
No.
Okay. All right, great. Well, I appreciate you coming in, coming down from the Cleveland Clinic and sharing this information. I learned a lot, which is, again, good timing. So.
Thank you.
In our last 30 seconds, I'll leave you with this. When it comes to things like DBS, and if it's something that you're looking into, as always, do your research. Continue to ask questions to your neurologist. There are so many different things that we don't know unless we ask the question. So just make sure that you're always checking in and keeping up to date. And with that, we will see you next time. Thank you.
The Secret Life of Parkinson's is produced by Melissa Carlson and Steve Brandenburg. To contact us, email info@thesecretlifeofpd.org. The Secret Life of Parkinson's is not responsible or liable for any medical advice, diagnosis, course of treatment, or any other information obtained through this podcast. The information provided by The Secret Life of Parkinson's is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you heard on this podcast. You are encouraged to consult a physician for a definitive diagnosis.
When you need need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
American Giant makes great clothing, t-shirts, jeans, and more, right here in the U.S., creating jobs in towns and cities across the country. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.